This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. My guest this week is Nick Terse, author of an amazingly researched and deeply disturbing new book called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Nick Terse, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. A very haunting book. How'd you get interested in this?
Well, I really stumbled onto this project. I began it as a graduate student. I was working on a project on post-traumatic stress disorder among U.S. Vietnam veterans, and I would head down to the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, and basically I was looking for hard data to match up against the self-reports that we had from veterans, what they told us about their service, when and where they served. And on one of these research trips, I'd been down at the archives for about 2 weeks, and every research avenue that I pursued was a dead end. I was just one failure after another. And finally, on my last day, I went to an archivist that I normally work with there, and I told him that, you know, I couldn't go back to my boss empty-handed. I needed something, at least a lead to go back with. And he thought about this for a moment, and then he said a few words that really changed my life. He asked me if witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress. And I told him I thought that was an excellent hypothesis and asked what he had on war crimes. And within an hour, I was searching through boxes to call it an information treasure trove is the wrong phrase. This was a horror trove. There were thousands and thousands of pages of reports of on massacres, murders, rapes, torture, mutilation. It was a horrific record that was put together by a secret Army task force that was run out of the Pentagon, which was designed to track war crimes cases and whenever they could tamp them down. And I recognized fairly quickly that this record wasn't in the literature anywhere. And, I decided to work on it, and that's what eventually led to Kill Anything That Moves.
Why do you think it wasn't in the literature? Why do you think no one had done anything with that?
Well, they had been, these records had been declassified, but they'd sat down on the archive shelf for about 7 years with no one really taking a close look at it. I asked the archivist right away. I said, has anyone been working with them? And he told me that you know, people had taken a look at maybe one or two individual cases, but never looked at the entire collection. So I think it was kind of, it was just forgotten there on the shelves. And this was the task force was secret at the time, so there were very few people that knew it existed in the years that it was in operation. It was run as an unofficial task force in secret out of the Army Chief of Staff's office in the Pentagon.
And were you a history grad student or a psychiatry grad student? What were you doing fishing in there?
I was trained in a dual degree program in history and public health. So I was trained as a public health professional, but also as a historian. And so I was well versed in history, and I taught myself history of the Vietnam War.
And the thrust of this book, Kill Anything That Moves, is that the My Lai massacre was not certainly the only massacre. In fact, it was more typical of what was going in Vietnam than what was atypical.
That's right. You know, there are about 30,000 books out there on the Vietnam War, if you can believe it, but not one that really attempts to tell the story of what I came to see as the signature aspect of the conflict, and that's you know, Vietnamese civilian suffering. You know, we know about My Lai, and this is generally in most books on the Vietnam War, the history of Vietnamese suffering during the war is distilled down to the My Lai massacre, where 500 civilians were killed over a period of 4 hours in March 1968. But over the course of the war, millions of Vietnamese were killed or wounded or made refugees due to deliberate U.S. policies, like the use of almost unrestrained bombing and artillery shelling across wide swaths of the countryside. So that's deliberate policies dictated at the highest levels of the U.S. military.
And some you go into some of that. I mean, it is amazing, and I've heard this before, and I think most recently in the Oliver Stone, Peter Kuznick incredible documentary on Showtime, The Untold History of the United States, where they say, in Vietnam, we dropped more bombs on the Vietnamese than were dropped on everybody during World War II. And you have some statistics in this book. You say there were 400,000 tons of napalm that the U.S. dropped and 30 billion pounds of munitions that the United States military used on the Vietnamese. And those are just staggering figures, as are the total figures for civilian deaths in Vietnam and Laos. What is your tally there? I mean, their numbers go 2 million, 3 million.
Yeah, I mean, we'll never know exactly how many Vietnamese civilians died in the war, but the best estimates that we have indicate about 2 million civilian dead. Add to that about 5.3 million civilians wounded. That's using a very conservative method of estimation. The U.S. government came up with a figure of 11 million Vietnamese made refugees during the war. And the latest studies show that as many as 4 million Vietnamese were exposed to toxic defoliants like Agent Orange. So we're talking about suffering on an almost unimaginable scale.
Yeah, and that is just, it's horrifying to contemplate in that magnitude and almost impossible to weigh, actually. But what you do in your book is you bring it down to these individual atrocities, too, that were committed. And you say that every major army unit in Vietnam committed atrocities, which, is an astonishing assertion that you back up. But it is astonishing to believe and puts the lie to the me lie exceptionalism.
Yes. This is something that, the records that I found really drove home to me. Now, of course, war crimes are kept secret by the people who commit them. So, you never end up with a full documentary record, but the records that do exist, it really drove home to me just how pervasive this was, because you saw it in every major unit. That's every division, every separate brigade, all these units that served over the entire course of the war and over the entire sweep of the country. So I could tell that this was exceptionally pervasive. That this was the rule, not the exception.
Yeah, you say it was a needle. You were looking. Ultimately, you thought you were looking for a needle in a haystack, but actually there were a haystack of needles. That was nicely put. Nick Terse, you got that document that started you on this trail and on this book. Whatever happened to those military investigations? Did they ever go forward with any prosecutions, or did they just kind of deep six everything?
Well, most of the investigations were killed somewhere in the investigatory process. There were some that actually led to charges, but a lot of times I found in the records it showed that that high-ranking generals would intervene and dismiss the charges. There was a much smaller percentage that went to court-martial proceedings, but I talked to people who served in the military justice system at the time, and they said that the entire system was really set up against these cases, that everyone wanted them to go away. So there were various ways to dismiss the cases, or many times you'd be convicted for just a piddling offense, not the major ones that were that you were charged with, and then in the very tiny percentage of cases that led to a conviction, it was very rare for anyone to get any kind of meaningful sentence. In the war crimes working group files, in these hundreds and hundreds of documents, the most severe penalty handed down was a 20-year sentence given to a military interrogator who raped a child. He raped a 13-year-old girl during his quote-unquote interrogation of her. And he received this 20 years at hard labor in prison. But the records indicate he served only about 7 months of that and then was let go. Mm-hmm. So this was the type of result that I found over and over again in the records.
So it's just impunity and impunity. What was it like to do the research and actually talking to soldiers? You went back and talked to U.S. soldiers 3 decades or more later, whose names had appeared in that file that you had or other files that you then came upon.
Yeah, I went and interviewed well over 100 U.S. veterans, witnesses to these types of crimes and also perpetrators. And, the responses were really, as you might imagine, it was really across the spectrum. There were some veterans who were not willing to talk, who would hang up on me when I called or slam a front door in my face. But in most cases, you know, once I demonstrated that I had some knowledge of the war, that I knew something of where and when they served and what their service was like, most of these men, even those who were reticent to talk at first, were willing to spend some time with me.
And if one of the perpetrators, how did they reconcile themselves to what they did, if they were willing to talk?
Well, again, it was a full spectrum of results. You know, there was, you know, to take one particular veteran, he had confessed to carrying out torture, to using water torture, what we now call waterboarding, or an electrical torture on prisoners. And, you know, I asked him about this, and he was, you know, totally unrepentant. He told me that if he was in a Vietnam-type situation again, this would be what he'd do. He thought it was the right thing to do. He thought it was correct for the war effort. But I guess it was probably atypical. Another veteran who really stuck with me. We were talking for a while. He was had a very infectious laugh. He was very jovial. We were talking for several hours, and then he quieted down, and he wanted to tell me a story about a fellow GI when they had gone into a village. And he told me they were setting the village on fire, which was standard operating procedure. This is the way that the Americans generally tried to drive the Vietnamese from the countryside, try and break their connection with the guerrillas. So they were burning down a village, and he said, a woman came up and was tugging on this GI's arm and yelling at him, obviously because her home was being burned down, all her possessions were being burnt up. And he said that the GI pushed her off, and then he took his rifle and hit her squarely in the face with the butt of his rifle, broke her nose, there was blood everywhere, she was screaming, and he said that this GI just walked away laughing. And then, you know, a couple moments later, he said, "You know that the GI was me."
Mm.
And I said, I thought that's where he was going with it. And he said to me, you know, I can't, he couldn't connect up, you know, his 19-year-old self with the man that he was when I was talking to him. He said he just couldn't believe he had done that. He wasn't sure how he could rake a woman's nose and then walk away laughing. And he said, you know, at the time, he didn't think anything of it. But in the years since, he couldn't get it out of his mind. So I think this is something that, that was more typical with the veterans that I talked to, that this was something they had to live with, something they did as you know, almost boys, and that they've been trying to grapple with ever since.
I'm speaking with Nick Terse. He's the author of this distressing book called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. Nick, how do you wrestle with that question that veteran asked himself? How could I have done that? How could they have done that?
Well, as I mentioned, he was 19 at the time, and I think this has to be taken into account. The typical American infantryman in Vietnam was 18, 19, 20 years old. They got to boot camp, and they were really socialized into a climate of extreme violence, and there was pervasive racism within their training. This is something that particular veteran and many other veterans talked to me about. They said that once they got to boot camp, they were told in no uncertain terms that you never refer to them as Vietnamese. You call them gooks, dinks, slopes, slants, all these slurs, with the idea that this would dehumanize the Vietnamese, that it would make them easier to kill. They were told that all the Vietnamese were potential enemies, that children might hold a grenade or women were making booby traps, and that it was better to shoot first. And they learned once they got to Vietnam that you could shoot first and no one would ask questions later. So many of the men were socialized into this and believed that, that they were under a grave threat, which they were in the field, and they often didn't see their enemies. The Vietnamese guerrillas were not going to go toe-to-toe with the Americans. They didn't have that type of firepower. So they used ambushes. They used sniper tactics and booby traps. So the Americans generally, when they came into a village, they didn't find any young men. They assumed all the young men of the village were enemy troops. They may have been, or they may have been serving with the Allied South Vietnamese forces, the Americans' allies, or they may have just run away because it was dangerous for them to be around. but the Americans would get angry and frustrated, and often they took it out on the only Vietnamese they could find, which was generally women and children and elderly men.
And you mentioned women. You document in this book, Nick Turse, Kill Anything That Moves, that rape was almost a standard operating procedure, too, in units. And that's disgusting to read about. There's also other just incredible sadism. I mean, soldiers dragging someone's mom by a rope behind an armored vehicle. Many accounts of soldiers cutting off the ears of Vietnamese or fingers, and some people actually making a necklace of the ears. That's beyond even comprehension. Is that a factor of just war makes you dehumanized, or is there something else going on there?
Well, I think there was a process of dehumanization there. When you talk about the mutilations, the Americans would mutilate bodies for a number of reasons. Again, as I mentioned, they often didn't see the enemy. So when they killed a Vietnamese, sometimes they would mutilate the body to leave there and send a message to other Vietnamese in the area. They had this a belief that in Buddhism, or you know, some of them didn't understand what exactly the Vietnamese religions were, but they believed that that if the body wasn't whole, then that the Vietnamese wouldn't go on to the afterlife, and that this would send a message of fear through the local population. So sometimes they used it in that way. Other times, the collection of ears was part and parcel of the U.S. System. The attrition strategy was based on body count. That the troops were rewarded for bringing in bodies, for producing bodies, because this was the metric that the Americans used to show that they were winning the war. So some commanders, demanded that ears be brought in so that you could prove a body count. So this was one of the reasons that ears were taken. And some veterans that I talked to said that that the ears were, they saw it as either a protective measure, or this was a way to show that they were hardened troops, that they were good soldiers. So there were a lot of reasons that mutilations took place.
I'm speaking with Nick Turse. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. Nick Turse is the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. And you do stress in your book, Nick, this obsession with body counts. And you say that was directly attributable to U.S. command policies at the highest level. There were so many things that were done cruelly to accelerate or inflate the body counts, and not making up numbers, but inventing ways or excuses for killing people, for killing innocent people. For instance, there was the idea that if someone is running away from a helicopter who's hovering above them, that they are an enemy because they're trying to run away. Well, it's an obvious thing. If you see a helicopter coming and you know that people are just being slaughtered in your own country, that you'd want to run away. I mean, that seemed to be the most ludicrous kind of rationale for wanton killing.
Yeah, this was another way that the body counts were driven up. You know, I went through sets of records that over and over again sort of told the same story, and talked to veterans who told the story. They would say that the helicopters would hover over Vietnamese who were working in a field. And they would stay there until the Vietnamese just became too crazed with fear, that they couldn't ignore this helicopter anymore, and they'd finally try and run for it, try and make it to a bomb shelter for safety, and be cut down. And then you'd call it in as an enemy evading, and this added to the body count. Troops on the ground did this too. Sometimes they would take a prisoner and then force the person to run at gunpoint and shoot them down. The very same reason. So this was part of the body count generation system.
So it was almost, if you're Vietnamese, you're a target, and if we kill you, it's an enemy combatant, as they say now in current Pentagon jargon. And so they just racked up these horrific totals. You focus on a couple of especially egregious commanders in one of your chapters, Nick Turse. Do you want to tell either the story of the Butcher of the Delta or Bummer?
Sure. The Butcher of the Delta was a general named Julian Ewell. And he had he'd been a World War II hero and then sort of languished in Washington for years at the Pentagon and as an attaché in the White House. But he finally got a combat command in Vietnam in 1968 in the wake of the 1968 Tet Offensive. And he really decided to make the most of this command. Became known, you know, as the Butcher of the Delta within and outside the military because of his extreme emphasis on body count. The subordinates under him, colonels under his command, said that he was nearly fanatical about this. Everything was body count, and he pushed his his subordinate commanders to produce these numbers, and they in turn pushed the troops under them, the infantrymen on the ground, and they were under extreme pressure, exceptional duress to produce Vietnamese bodies. And Ewell's signature action was an operation called Speedy Express, which kicked off in December 1968 and ran until the end of May 1969. And over the course of that operation, the U.S. military claimed almost 11,000 enemy dead, but they recovered less than 750 weapons. So there was this tremendous disparity. And a couple of years after this operation took place, two reporters from Newsweek magazine would investigate it. And they came to the conclusion that 5,000 civilians were killed during the operation. So this is 10 times the death toll of My Lai. But what the Newsweek reporters didn't know, and what I found in the archives, was that there was an internal whistleblower who wrote to the Army's top generals and told them exactly what was going on during Speedy Express. But the Army did nothing. And then when the Newsweek article came out, the military looked into the case and conducted its own investigation. And it decided that Newsweek's estimate was a low-end count. The military's own secret report guessed that up to 7,000 of the dead were civilians. 7,000 of 11,000. It was it was truly shocking to me.
And whatever happened to this guy?
Well, Ewell eventually was promoted from his command of the 9th Infantry Division in the Mekong Delta to what was then the largest U.S. combat command in the world. It was elsewhere in Vietnam, where he was commanding. There were several generals then under his command, and from there he was promoted up to become the official attaché to the Paris peace talks. Looking to end the Vietnam War.
Amazing, isn't it? You got hold of this document from someone who signed his name Concerned Sergeant, and this was the guy you were referring to who had described to the command what had been going on there, I think, and you never were able to talk with the Concerned Sergeant, right?
I wasn't. He wrote these letters to General William Westmoreland, who had been the Supreme Commander in Vietnam and who was then the Army Chief of Staff, and then some other top generals. He was begging them to take action. He said that he didn't want to cause the Army trouble. He didn't want to cause a huge scandal, but he wanted them to stop the killing. And I found in the records that they did identify this man. They identified him as provisionally as George Lewis, a man who did serve in the 9th Infantry Division during Speedy Express. He would have seen it all. But then George Lewis went silent, and they were supposed to contact him, and it's unclear from the records what happened. But by the time I began to investigate this, unfortunately, George Lewis had passed away, so I was never able to find out, what eventually stopped his campaign and why he went silent and didn't go to the New York Times as he had threatened to do.
Yeah, it must have been heartbreaking as a researcher to find out that he was dead. I know as a reporter, sometimes that's to reach that dead end is very frustrating. Yeah. You had some fruitful and also haunting experiences going to Vietnam and doing research there. Can you talk about what that was like?
Sure. I went to Vietnam with these records in hand, looking for witnesses and survivors to these individual cases. And in many cases, I was able to track down people who were involved in the very cases that I found in the National Archives records. But, you know, I went to talk to these Vietnamese about one specific spasm of violence, but what they told me really changed the way I conceptualized the war, and it changed my book from one about atrocities to one about Vietnamese civilian suffering, because I went to talk about this one event, but what they would tell me about was what it was like to live for 10 years under bombs and shells and helicopter gunships, and how they had to negotiate their lives around the American war, and what this really meant, how this daily series of calculations that had to be made to try and keep themselves alive and keep their families alive.
These were calculations like, you know, do we go into the bomb shelter now, or do we leave the bomb shelter, or do we go into the field, do we leave the field, things like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, their entire lives were predicated around the war, just one wrong decision might mean that your entire family was wiped out. If you came out of that bunker, the bomb shelter, you know, a second too early or decided to leave it a second too late, it might mean being cut down in crossfire above ground or having grenades roll in because the Americans saw these as enemy fighting positions. They didn't realize or they didn't want to know that all Vietnamese had to build bomb shelters because of the immense amount of firepower. And this story that they told me, this story of suffering of 10 years of this, it really made a profound impact on me, and I realized that this was the story I wanted to tell, their story.
I'm speaking with Nick Turse. He's the author of Kill Anything That Moves, the Real American War in Vietnam. We've got less than 2 minutes left, Nick, and I just wonder, you know, what conclusions do we draw going forward here or about current U.S. policy in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Yemen or even the historical record on Vietnam? I know Reagan and Bush 1 and Bush 2 were always hoping that we'd get over the Vietnam complex. How do you see us wrestling with Vietnam currently?
Well, you know, since America's constantly involved in military conflicts abroad, in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, Somalia these last years, I think it's important that Americans understand what war is really like, especially for the people who live with it every day, namely civilians. Wars cause immense suffering, but the stories of civilians affected by America's wars rarely make the front pages of newspapers or lead the nightly news. And I think if Americans are called upon to send their brothers and sisters and sons and daughters to war, they ought to have a clear idea of what that means for the sons and daughters of people overseas. And I hope that my book can help to contribute to that conversation.
I think it really has, Nick Turse. And the other thing that it contributes to is skepticism. Skepticism that we need to have when we're told by a president or we're told by a CIA director or a counterterrorism official that every person that's been killed is a militant or that every male in a region is a okay target to go kill. And that's what we've been told time and again. And we were told that in Vietnam, and we're told that in Afghanistan. Nick Turse has been my guest today on Progressive Radio. He's the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Nick Turse, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.